Good morning and a warm welcome to everyone present today on behalf of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. This hearing is part of the 149th regular session of the Commission, and in this particular hearing we will be considering and receiving information on freedom of expression and communication surveillance by the United States. I'm pleased to let you know that I'm joined by my fellow commissioners and the Special Rapporteur for Freedom of Expression. Commissioner Rodrigo Escobar Gil is here, as well as Commissioner Felipe Gonzalez and Commissioner Rosemarie Antoine, and the Special Rapporteur for Freedom of Expression, Catalina Botera. The hearing today is requested by the American Civil Liberties Foundation, the ACLU, and we are very pleased to welcome the UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and the Protection of the Right to Freedom of Opinion and Expression, who is well known to us at the Commission, Frank LaRue. Welcome. We also are grateful to have the presence of the United States and its representatives, the Deputy Permanent Representative, Lawrence Gambino, and his team. I wish to hand over first to the petitioners and to those who will provide us with information. The purpose of this hearing is to ensure that the Commission has relevant information about the nature and scope of communication surveillance technologies and techniques that have been developed and practiced by the United States National Security Agency, and to help the Commission to understand the implications of that type of surveillance in the area of human rights.
Madam Commissioner, Honorable Commissioners, representatives of the Government of the United States. My name is Stephen Watt. I am a Senior Staff Attorney with the Human Rights Program of the American Civil Liberties Union. The ACLU requested today's hearing following media reports from the United States that the U.S. National Security Agency is conducting surveillance of hundreds of millions of people around the world. The government has sought to justify this mass surveillance on national security grounds, yet official reports indicate that the NSA has conducted surveillance of the communications of world leaders, of allied foreign powers, UN and EU offices, foreign corporations, and countless numbers of innocent Americans and foreign nationals. The NSA's dragnet surveillance programs have understandably been the subject of great public concern both here in the United States and internationally. The international community, led by the United Nations, has begun the process of assessing NSA-type mass surveillance programs in the light of relevant human rights laws and standards. At today's hearing, we will provide the Commission with information necessary for the Commission to start this process at the regional human rights level. And with me on the panel today is speaking first, Mr. Frank LaRue, the current UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Expression and the author of two recent and groundbreaking reports on the internet and surveillance in the digital age. Mr. LaRue will address the human rights framework that should ground state surveillance programs. Alex Abdo is a senior staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union. He works with the National Security Project and has been involved in litigation of NSA surveillance programs in U.S. courts. Mr. Abdo will provide information on the NSA surveillance programs and their impacts on the rights of both U.S. and non-U.S. citizens. And finally, without the courage of Edward Snowden, a former contractor with the NSA, leaking documents on NSA surveillance practices to the media, the vigorous public debate that is now taking place on the legality of these programs would not exist. And this is a debate that President Obama himself has welcomed. So Emmy McLean of Open Society Justice Initiative will address the related issue of human rights protections for whistleblowers like Edward Snowden who work in the national security sector. Thank you, Mr. LaRue.
Thank you very much. Quisiera agradecer en primer lugar a la Comisión esta oportunidad y decirles que me es muy grato, tanto como relator de Naciones Unidas, pero también como anterior peticionario y usuario del Sistema Interamericano de Derechos Humanos y como amigo del sistema, estar presente en esta audiencia. Let me mention a couple of things. One is that I'm relating two of my recent reports, and the report on surveillance, state surveillance of communication, privacy, and freedom of expression was prior to the Snowden disclosures. So it's very important to say that I drafted this report not in relationship with one incident or one country, but it was a report drafted with the idea of establishing global principles around the world for all countries at all time. I was very conscious, and I say it in my report, that I'm linking two different rights, the right to privacy with the right to freedom of expression. They're very distinct rights with the different articles that norm it and different forms of protection, but that are intrinsically linked because freedom of expression cannot be exercised if privacy is not respected. And privacy, the right to privacy, guarantees the sense of freedom and creativity, and especially the freedom of expressing opinions that everyone must need to be able to feel safe in exercising this right. Secondly, I say in my report that I'm not denying the fact that we are living in a particular world today where violence and terrorism, and in some countries like in Latin America, organized crime is a real threat. I'm not denying the threat. I'm not challenging the questions, the obligations of national security that every state has. I believe that all states not only must put a major effort, but have an obligation to guarantee security to all of its citizens and all people in their territory. But having said that, what I say in my report is that national security has to be understood as something that protects individuals, but it also protects democratic institutions, and it protects democracy as a whole, which is the challenges we're suffering. So we cannot put in mechanisms, issues or procedures or surveillance techniques that supposedly guarantee the security of individuals against acts of terror or violence, but harm our democratic institutions and harm the democratic principles that lead any country in the world. This is a contradiction which we cannot live with, because ultimately it will come and haunt us. So all mechanisms of protection have to be done within the framework of law in a democratic system. So there has to be a due process of law procedure to establish these mechanisms. Surveillance is not new. It happened with written letters. It happened with telephone calls. But it was always related to the investigation authorized by a judge and was always related to some degree of vigilance by parliamentary special commissions. And I believe, and I say in my report, that it's important for the sake of protecting rights that most states have the double system, the system of judiciary oversight and parliamentary vigilance on these mechanisms within a specific procedure. What is not permissible from a human rights point of view is that those that hold political power or those that are in security agencies or even less, those that work in intelligence agencies decide by themselves, for themselves, what is going to be the scope of breaching the right to privacy and who will they target or maybe not even target, who will they blanket surveil. And this is the problem we're finding in the world, because if we allow this to happen in any of the cases with any justification, it will inevitably become an abusive system where power will be imposed on people and opinions of dissent or criticism will be stifled. And therefore, this breach of privacy will inevitably in any country become a form of censorship. And this is what's unacceptable. There has to be a legal procedure in place for it to happen, and there has to be transparency. The parliament has to monitor, parliament, Congress, whatever it's called in every country, or the society has to know, and those that have suffered surveillance have to be notified of the fact that this has happened. Of course, today the scandal is because many heads of state of foreign countries have suffered this. But we believe this is very sensitive issue because of diplomatic relations, but it is equally important when common citizens are suffering a breach of their privacy as well. Because in this case, the surprise was the massiveness of the phenomenon. And in this massiveness of surveillance, it is the massiveness of the fear it provokes for exercising freedom of expression and freedom of thought. Finally, on my second report, this report, by the way, I presented on the 3rd of June. I will give the Commission a copy, Madam Chairperson, and I will gladly share all my opinions, some of which I have also shared and worked together with the Special Rapporteur of this Commission, with Ms. Catalina Botero. I have also worked my latest report, which was presented on Friday, on the 25th of October, on access to public information and the right to truth. The right to truth is something very well known in this commission, but traditionally linked to Articles 1, 8, and 25 of the American Convention. What I was trying to do is to close the circle and say the right to truth is linked to 1, 8, 25, and 13, because any information related to human rights violations, which is called the right to truth of human rights violations, should also be a privileged sector of the access to information. When we talk about access to information, we're talking normally about transparency and finances, but I believe that this transparency goes to political decisions as well, how political decisions are made, how policies are established, and the possibility of any citizen to know how the decision-making process of those in public office happens. And the logic of this is those that hold public office hold the authority in the name of the people and seeking the common good. So there is no reason for secrecy except for some very, very small cases. Here I say that also in access to the information related to human rights violations, there should be less of an exception limit. And we have been working with a series of organizations in the Schwane Principles on access to information related to human rights violations. We establish, I think, a legitimate framework of what could be considered in a very minimal way the legitimate limitations. I would certainly encourage this commission to have a revision of these principles, and I am actually encouraging all regional bodies to adopt the principles to make them universal in some way, as I presented them to the General Assembly this past week. And finally, the last word on whistleblowers. If access to information related to human rights violation is known as the right to truth, and the right to truth is a privileged right, not only of those that are victims and their relatives, as it was in the past, but now of everyone in society, because it's very relevant for a democracy to see why human rights violations occur. Therefore, the release of information regarding human rights violations should carry no liability with it. It is important to say that anyone, any not only journalist, but any individual who possesses or receives information regarding human rights violation can use it to denounce those violations, regardless of where it was obtained from and how. I think this is a very important principle, a difficult one to understand, but this is we must prioritize the defense of human rights over everything else. And unless there is a breach of security for individuals and put the in danger, in serious danger individuals, the access to information related to human rights violations should be a priority for the state, but also for all society, and therefore there should be a protection for whistleblowers in this regard. These are the principles I establish in my two reports, which I would gladly share. I have been visiting Brazil recently, and there is a World Forum on Human Rights, where I have been asked to develop this further in December, and it would be very important to have the accompaniment of this commission, and especially of the Special Rapporteur for Freedom of Expression, who has also been invited by the government of Brazil to participate in this event. Thank you very much.
Distinguished commissioners and representatives of the United States, on behalf of the ACLU, I would like to thank the Commission for holding this timely hearing and for the opportunity to testify before it. Over the last 4 months, it has become clear that the NSA is engaged in far-reaching and intrusive surveillance of the communications of Americans and non-Americans alike. Under Section 215 of the Patriot Act, the NSA is tracking every single phone call made by a resident of the United States, whom they called, when they called them, and for how long they spoke. Until recently, it was tracking ordinary Americans' internet activity as well. Under Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, called the FISA Amendments Act, the NSA is conducting sweeping surveillance, both of Americans' international communications and of foreigners' communications. In our written testimony, we explained the surveillance programs operating under these two statutes. This morning, however, I would like to focus on the FISA Amendments Act, because I believe that the scope of surveillance that the NSA has instituted under that statute poses a unique threat to international privacy and expression. Under the FISA Amendments Act, the NSA is authorized to engage in dragnet surveillance of international communications when two conditions are satisfied. First, the targets of the NSA's surveillance must be foreigners. Second, the purpose of the NSA's surveillance must be to gather foreign intelligence. Neither of these restrictions has any bite. Although the NSA must target its surveillance efforts, it is authorized to monitor international communications about its targets. The NSA has interpreted this authority to allow it to scan the contents of any international communication for keywords related to its targets. In practice, the NSA appears to implement this interpretation of its authority by creating a copy of an enormous quantity of international communications that transit major telecommunications switches, scanning them for specific keywords, and then segregating for longer-term storage those that match its search. Additionally, the phrase foreign intelligence, which is the second condition, is defined extraordinarily broadly to include information related to the United States' foreign affairs. Therefore, the NSA surveillance is not limited to the investigation of suspected terrorists or criminals, but it includes the gathering of information about anything relevant to American interests abroad. That lax requirement is implemented even more laxly. Based on documents leaked by Edward Snowden, we now know that the NSA considers the fact that a foreigner is a party to a communication to be evidence that the communication itself contains foreign intelligence and is therefore targetable. The effect of the NSA's broad understanding of its surveillance authority under the FISA Amendments Act is simply this: to make virtually every international communication fair game for surveillance by the NSA. Under the FISA Amendments Act, the NSA could monitor foreign journalists to discover their sources or to learn about their country's politics. It could target foreign human rights defenders to determine what they know about the United States' involvement in abusive interrogation or in foreign drone strikes, and it could target foreign dissidents who are challenging the authority of regimes allied with the United States. Under the FISA Amendments Act, the NSA could even target foreign corporations to protect America's international economic interests. It could target the foreign lawyers who represent Guantanamo Bay detainees to see how much they've learned of their clients' mistreatment. And it could target the foreign members of this commission while they are abroad to find out, for example, those members' views of the recent controversy surrounding the NSA's surveillance practices. Recent news stories have confirmed that the NSA's surveillance is in fact this broad in practice. Two separate programs, known as PRISM and Upstream, collect the content of electronic communications in which at least one party is believed to be a non-US person. Documents have confirmed that at least 29 foreign nations have been subjected to surveillance by the NSA. Recently, the media reported that the NSA collects and stores data from approximately half a billion German communications each month. Le Monde reported that over a one-month period, the NSA collected 70 million records of French citizens' telephone data. And just this morning, El Mundo reported that also in a one-month period, the NSA collected information on more than 60 million calls in Spain. The NSA has also engaged in targeted surveillance of friendly foreign governments, including members of the Organization of American States. Reports recently surfaced that the U.S. had monitored the phone calls of the President of Brazil and the communications of Petrobras, Brazil's state oil corporation. And just last week, Der Spiegel revealed that the NSA had hacked email accounts of former President of Mexico, Felipe Calderón, and his cabinet. Reports also indicate that the NSA has bugged the headquarters of the United Nations and the European Union. The NSA's sweeping view of its authority to monitor international communications should be of particular concern to this commission. We now live in an age in which digital communications not only enhance our expressive and associational freedoms, but has become central to them. Our ability to trust the relative security of those communications, however, has been deeply eroded by the astonishing breadth of the NSA surveillance. Simply put, if every country were to engage in surveillance as unfettered as the NSA, we would soon live in a world of pervasive monitoring. And if every country were to embrace as seemingly lenient a policy on the sharing of surveillance with other countries, there would be no refuge for the world's dissidents, journalists, and human rights defenders. It is our hope that the Commission will help forestall these possibilities by recommending that in conducting surveillance, the United States respect and ensure the rights to freedom and expression and privacy long established in international law. Thank you again for the invitation to testify.
Distinguished commissioners, special rapporteur, and representatives of the United States, I'd like to express my appreciation, as my colleagues have, for your holding this important hearing and for the opportunity to be here today. My statement today and the more expansive written submission that accompanies it are limited to three areas: the public right to information, and especially information of high public interest, including where it relates to national security; the state obligation to protect from sanction those who possess or disclose information in the public interest; and more generally, to limit sanctions on unauthorized disclosures; and the lack of appropriate protection in the United States for public interest disclosures in the security sector. As has been discussed here today already and widely reported around the world, unauthorized disclosures by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden in recent months have unearthed massive and previously little known U.S. state surveillance programs. Much needs to be analyzed regarding the consistency or lack thereof of U.S. surveillance practices with domestic and international law, and I'm grateful that this commission is seized of the matter. However, as Mr. Watt said in his introduction, this case also compels consideration of the treatment of the person who provoked this debate and others like him. International law permits legitimate restrictions of freedom of expression and the public's right to know on national security grounds. Yet these restrictions must be well-grounded, narrow, and strictly interpreted consistent with the principle of maximum disclosure. Further, information related to national security is not exempt from public access for that reason alone. Indeed, the importance of public access to government information concerning the security sector is of particular importance because of the discretion typically afforded the executive in this area, the state's great powers, including to wage war and conduct counterterrorism operations, and its oversight of significant public funds. Here, undue deference to arguments concerning national security secrecy can and have contributed to human rights violations, corruption, waste and abuses, with accountability hampered by secrecy. As U.S. Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart wrote in the Pentagon Papers case, the only effective restraint upon executive policy and power in the areas of national defense and international affairs may lie in an enlightened citizenry. Within a system of universally acknowledged overclassification, the elimination of unauthorized disclosures in the public interest, or leaks, would effectively eviscerate the public's ability to monitor government actions related to defense and national security. Yet, in a dramatic shift from the past, the United States is aggressively pursuing leakers as spies and undermining media freedom in the process, regardless of any relevant public interest considerations. Relevant U.S. law governing sanctions for the unauthorized possession or disclosure of classified information or information otherwise related to national security is largely, but not exclusively, found in the 1917 Espionage Act. The Espionage Act was enacted in the World War I era to punish spies who disclosed protected information to a foreign enemy, but it has been used more broadly to punish disclosures to the public without any intent to disclose to a foreign enemy. In strikingly broad language, it provides for 10 years imprisonment for each count of unauthorized possession or disclosure of classified or national defense information, or for the conspiracy to do so. Most provisions sanctioning the unauthorized possession or disclosure of defense or security-related information within the Espionage Act and related laws are universally applicable to both public servants with security clearance and private persons, though in only one instance has the government indicted private persons under the Espionage Act for leaks.
The United States has a whistleblower protection regime, but its availability is virtually non-existent for security sector personnel. A presidential policy directive issued in October 2012 purports to support security sector reporting of waste, fraud, and abuse in recognition of the limitations of existing regulations. Yet it, too, is lacking. It does not apply to contractors or members of the armed forces, does not provide for any legal mechanism to redress retaliation, creates an administrative review mechanism which is purely discretionary, and does not even make the determination and proposed remedy of the administrative review mechanism binding on the intelligence agency. U.S. law concerning the prosecution of leaks and protections of whistleblowers does not comply with international legal standards related to freedom of expression information for several fundamental reasons. The offenses are vague and overbroad and lack requisite intent and harm requirements, nor has the executive or the courts read such requirements into the statutes. The offenses and penalties also do not sufficiently take into account the public interest in disclosure of certain information or provide adequate whistleblower protections for security sector personnel. Moreover, for most offenses, the law does not distinguish between public servants, on the one hand, and the media and the public, on the other, in terms of applicable offenses or penalties. Further, U.S. law criminalizes conspiracy to commit offense at the same level as the actual offense, without sufficient protections for journalists or public watchdogs. Indeed, in recent years, the government has increasingly threatened the prosecution of journalists and watchdogs for conspiracy. Finally, the penalties for unauthorized possession and disclosure under U.S. law are disproportionately severe, with chilling effects. The breathtaking expansiveness of the Espionage Act has benefited historically from executive discretion limiting leak prosecutions. In the more than 60 years between World War II and the beginning of the Obama administration, there were only 3 Espionage Act indictments related to disclosures to the media. This has changed radically under the current administration. Over the less than 5 years in which Barack Obama has been president, the U.S. government has issued 8 indictments in relation to leaks to the media, relying on the Espionage Act. These include indictments for disclosures which have revealed human rights violations, war crimes, fraud and waste, and other information of public interest. Further, those who have received or were suspected of receiving leaks, including journalists, have in some instances been subject to targeted surveillance, threatened with prosecution or alleged to be co-conspirators in the crime, ordered to disclose or testify against their sources, or penalized for the refusal to do so. While no journalist has thus far been prosecuted under the Espionage Act, the aggressive enforcement of unauthorized disclosures in recent years suggests that may be a real threat. As one New York Times journalist described, the crackdown had its intended effect, both prosecuting the underlying cases and scaring others into not talking. Another veteran national security journalist said, "Chilling isn't quite strong enough. It's more like freezing the whole process into a standstill." So in addition to laying out the concerns with the U.S. law, I'd like to briefly acknowledge also the set of global principles on national security and right to information that Mr. LaRue mentioned, which were released earlier this year, and, as Mr. LaRue did, urge the Commission to consider endorsing them. Based on international and national law and standards, they provide guidance crucial to these discussions, setting out detailed guidelines on the appropriate limits of secrecy, including the role of and protection for whistleblowers, limitations on sanctions for national security leaks, and information related to state surveillance for which there should be presumptive disclosure. These principles were elaborated in collaboration with relevant special mandate holders, including my distinguished co-panelist, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of the Right to Freedom of Opinion and Expression, and this commission's distinguished Special Rapporteur for Freedom of Expression. They have been endorsed by the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, and we are also currently engaged with the Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression and Access to Information of the African Commission on Human and People's Rights to seek endorsement of the principles within the African system as well. I can speak more about the specific principles, perhaps, in the discussion if there's not sufficient time now. I'm not sure how we are on time. Or
I can
say
you,
a few words.
I can give you a minute or two.
Okay. So relevant to the theme of this hearing, I would just like to highlight a few specific principles. Under principles 4 and 9, governments may legitimately withhold information in narrowly defined areas, such as defense plans and the operations and sources used by intelligence services. However, in each instance, the government bears the burden of proof to demonstrate the necessity of restrictions on the right to public information. Pursuant to principle 10A, governments should never withhold information on violations of international human rights and humanitarian law, including information about the circumstances and perpetrators of torture and crimes against humanity, the location of secret prisons, or information about past abuses of international human rights or humanitarian law under previous regimes. Under Principle 30, governments may not keep information confidential that prevents victims of human rights violations from seeking or obtaining a remedy. Under Principles 10C and 10E, the public has a right to know about the existence of all security sector entities and their budgets, as well as systems of surveillance, the legal framework governing them, and the procedures for authorizing surveillance and using, sharing, storing, and destroying intercepted material. Under Principles 40, 41, and 43, whistleblowers in the public sector should not face retaliation if the public information disclosed outweighs the public interest in secrecy. But where an effective mechanism exists, they should first make a reasonable effort to address the issue through official complaint mechanisms. Under Principles 43 and 46, criminal action against those who leak information should be considered only if the information poses a real and identifiable risk of causing significant harm that overrides the public interest in disclosure, and if the law clearly sets forth narrow categories of information whose disclosure poses a high likelihood of causing harm. And finally, Principles 47 and 48, the media and others who are not public servants should not be sanctioned for receiving, possessing, or disclosing classified information to the public, or for conspiracy or other crimes based on their seeking or accessing classified information. Placing the onus on the state to keep confidential information secret strikes a proper balance between the needs of legitimate secrecy and the high public interest in robust watchdogs and the disclosure of certain information, critical for public oversight. The media and other private persons should also not be forced to reveal a confidential source or other published information in a leak investigation. In closing, the Commission's endorsement of these principles would be important for considerations of U.S. law and practice, but also for other countries in the region grappling with questions related to the appropriate limits on national security secrecy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Can I turn to the United States and your representatives to offer your observations?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Distinguished commissioners, Special Rapporteur for Freedom of Expression, Executive Secretary, petitioners, and Secretariat colleagues. My name is Lawrence Gambiner. I am the Deputy Permanent Representative of the United States Mission to the Organization of American States. I am joined here at the table by Ms. Rachel Owen, also of our U.S. Mission to the OAS, Ms. Margaret Pickering of the State Department's legal staff, and Mr. Andrew Stevenson of the U.S. Mission to the Organization of American States. It is a pleasure for all of us to be here today. I would like to begin by reaffirming that the United States takes the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights and its role in the OAS very seriously and is committed to addressing with you human rights issues in the hemisphere, including in the United States. We have worked steadfastly in recent years to increase our engagement with the Commission on important human rights issues facing our country. We have actively participated in Commission meetings, hearings, and expert consultations. We are dedicated to this process and make every effort to ensure the appropriate level of participation to provide the Commission with the opportunity to engage with a full array of policymakers and decision makers in the U.S. government. We take pride in the Commission's role in our region and are open to engagement, and we welcome the hearings today on this particular topic of concern to NGOs, civil society, and the public. However, events in the last month have prevented the United States from preparing sufficiently in order to engage as fully as we would like for today's hearing. Consistent with the Commission's rules providing for no less than 30 days' notice of hearings, the United States received 4 notices for hearings on the evening of Friday, September 27, which each included voluminous statements and submissions by interested private persons. Just a few days later, on October 1, most of the United States federal government shut down and did not reopen until October 17. This extraordinary event, something that has not happened in the United States for 17 years and never during the period immediately prior to a commission session, prevented the United States from undertaking full and adequate preparations for the hearings today. With the government closed and most of its employees furloughed, we lost the time essential for us to engage our interagency colleagues and prepare for these hearings. In particular, many of the specific government agencies with expertise in the matters to be raised today did not have staff on the job to consider the Commission's communications and assist in preparations. It was for these reasons that on October 8, and again on October 18, the United States sent separate letters to the Commission requesting a postponement of all U.S. hearings and working meetings until the February 2014 sessions. Please be aware that we made these requests after much consultation and with the understanding that petitioners, NGOs, and the public deserve robust participation from the United States, something we knew would not be possible with such a limited amount of time. The experts from throughout our government who returned to work after more than 2 weeks of furlough were not able at this late stage to identify witnesses, prepare testimony, gather documentation, and do the work necessary to fully respond to the issues before us. Given the sensitive and important nature of the matters before the Commission, and because the United States takes its engagement with the Commission seriously, it typically takes us the entire 30-day period for my government to prepare fully researched and coordinated responses. The bottom line is that, unfortunately, today we are not in the position to address the issues raised in your petition. We are here to carefully listen to what the petitioners and witnesses have to say and to take on board any questions or comments from the Commission. However, since we will not be in a position to provide responses today, we do propose and commit to follow up in writing in the next 30 days on all of these matters. We would welcome an opportunity to appear and discuss these issues at a further and future hearing before the Commission. We would like to thank you for raising the issues and assure you that we will follow up in the coming weeks. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Deputy Permanent Representative. I'm also joined by Executive Secretary Emilio Alvarez y Casa. And as I mentioned in the last hearing, the Commission received and had due regard to the request from the United States to postpone this and other hearings, which involved the United States. The Commission considered that the importance of the issues, we ought to go ahead, and we also had regard to the interests and wishes of the petitioners, and we welcome the opportunity which the state will afford us to, in writing, give a full response. And I'll also reiterate, as I offered in the last commission, in the last hearing, that the Commission receives requests from states for hearings on human rights issues, and we welcome requests from the United States as well in relation to any of the matters which are the subject of hearings. I wish to offer the floor first to the Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression, Catalina Botera, to offer her comments and questions for the state.
Gracias, Presidenta. Yo quiero agradecerle a los peticionarios muy especialmente por esta importantísima audiencia y, por supuesto, a los representantes del Gobierno de los Estados Unidos, bueno, por su participación y por el ofrecimiento de responder las preguntas dentro de los 30 días siguientes a la audiencia. Como el Gobierno de los Estados Unidos sabe, la Relatoría está muy preocupada por el alcance de los programas de vigilancia que se han puesto de presente. Lo hemos dicho en distintas instancias y públicamente lo hemos expresado a través de los comunicados de prensa conjuntos con el relator de Naciones Unidas. Yo quiero reiterar aquí algunas preocupaciones, particularmente tres tipos de preocupaciones, y quisiera saber si se puede profundizar tanto los peticionarios como el gobierno en su respuesta. El primero tiene que ver con los controles para asegurar mayor transparencia y control y límite a los programas de vigilancia, de manera tal que al mismo tiempo que protejan la seguridad nacional puedan proteger la privacidad, la libertad de expresión, no solo de los nacionales, sino de los extranjeros. El gobierno ha dicho que ha creado que va a crear un grupo de expertos para revisar el funcionamiento de los programas de vigilancia, de los programas de vigilancia que se han puesto de presente. Yo quisiera saber qué se ha hecho al respecto. Quisiera saber cuáles son las propuestas para reformar la Corte de Vigilancia Extranjera. Uno de los grandes asuntos que se pone de presente en la audiencia y en todo el debate es la falta de información suficiente y de capacidad de esa Corte para ejercer un control independiente y adecuado. Quisiera saber qué medidas se están adoptando para que la Corte pueda tener mayor capacidad, mayores controles, mayor independencia para poder ejercer su función. Y en particular respecto de la prensa, en este primer tema de controles, también se ha anunciado una reforma de las directrices sobre recolección de metadatos, sobre todo en lo que tiene que ver con las agencias de prensa, los periodistas y los medios de comunicación. Y yo quisiera saber en qué consisten esas directrices para el control de recolección de metadatos. El segundo tema que me parece importante es el que tiene que ver con la protección de las comunicaciones, la privacidad y la libertad de expresión de los extranjeros con comunicación, en sus comunicaciones a través de las empresas estadounidenses. Quisiera saber si el grupo de expertos y las propuestas de reforma que se están planteando tienen en cuenta la necesidad de proteger los derechos humanos universales de todas las personas, particularmente de los extranjeros que utilizan empresas estadounidenses. Y el tercer tema tiene que ver con acceso a la información y protección de informantes. Bueno, ya se pusieron de presente los principios en los cuales la Relatoría cree, la Relatoría ha trabajado en esos principios y los acompaña. Y por eso para nosotros es preocupante el retroceso en materia de acceso a la información, es decir, cuáles son los criterios que se están utilizando para definir cuál es la información que se debe reservar y particularmente la protección de los informantes. Quisiéramos saber cuáles son las garantías que existen en los Estados Unidos para que las personas que, los funcionarios públicos, que difunden información reservada, por lo tanto violan el deber de reserva, pero es una información de altísimo interés público, particularmente relacionada con las violaciones de derechos humanos, ¿qué garantías tienen de no ser procesados, de que no se aplique la ley de espionaje y particularmente de que no se aplique el tipo de ayuda al enemigo, que para la Relatoría es un tipo penal particularmente peligroso? Esos serían los tres temas que yo quisiera dejar de presente. Podríamos profundizarlos más adelante en una carta específica al Estado, pero si hubiera algún comentario sobre esos temas, se los agradecería.
Commissioner Antoine, any questions or comments?
Gracias. Bueno, le agradezco a los peticionarios y a los representantes del Estado por sus presentaciones. Una primera cosa, aquí a la Comisión Interamericana suelen llegar casos en los cuales se presenta un conflicto entre libertad de expresión y privacidad, especialmente a propósito de observaciones o dichos de unos particulares respecto de otros, o unos particulares respecto de autoridades públicas, en fin. Pero de acuerdo a la información que se ha venido allegando aquí, la que ha recabado la Comisión con anterioridad a esta audiencia, pareciera que se trata, en cambio, de una situación en la que tanto el derecho a la privacidad como el derecho a la libertad de expresión podrían estar afectados. Y en ese sentido, las cosas que aquí se han venido señalando, y como las que mencionaba hace un momento la relatora especial de libertad de expresión de la Comisión, son muy importantes en el sentido de que tiene que avanzarse hacia un mecanismo que, asumiendo la legitimidad de, la, de las labores de seguridad de los estados, no resulte invasiva de los derechos de las personas. En este sentido, Estados Unidos tiene una larga tradición en su jurisprudencia constitucional, por ejemplo, en el sentido de que los organismos del Estado deben usar los medios menos invasivos, o sea, less restrictive, less intrusive means, respecto de su acopio de información, de manera que sea lo menos intrusivo posible en la privacidad y en el impacto que esto puede tener en materia de libertad de expresión de las personas. Por otra parte, también es muy relevante lo que se refiere a la ausencia, según la información allegada, de check and balances que funcionen adecuadamente. Tenemos las declaraciones que ha hecho hace algunos días un juez que encabeza el Tribunal de la Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, que dijo que the court lacks the tools to independently verify how often the government surveillance breaks the court's rules that aim to protect Americans' privacy. Without taking drastic steps, it also cannot check the veracity of the government's assertions that the violations its staff members report are intentional mistakes. El problema es que con un programa de esta envergadura y con este alcance, es evidente que cualquier forma de control se vuelve prácticamente ilusoria. Cuando son decenas de millones las comunicaciones que están siendo monitoreadas. De allí que parezca necesario tanto acotar ese tipo de investigaciones como establecer un sistema adecuado de control por órganos independientes por parte del Estado y que también la sociedad civil pueda hacer eso a su vez. Gracias.
Quiero comenzar por agradecer la participación de los peticionarios, expresar también el agrado por la participación del relator especial de las Naciones Unidas para la libertad del pensamiento y de expresión por la importante información que nos ha presentado, agradecer la participación del Estado, pero nuevamente reiterar la frustración de la Comisión, la frustración de los peticionarios, la frustración de la sociedad civil y de toda la comunidad internacional que está viendo en directo esta audiencia por la falta de información por parte de los Estados Unidos frente a una problemática de tanta actualidad. En realidad, la petición de aplazamiento de las audiencias por parte de las autoridades de los Estados Unidos fue debidamente evaluada por la Comisión y consideramos que no existía ninguna circunstancia de fuerza mayor. Una circunstancia de fuerza mayor como un terremoto, un fenómeno de la naturaleza, bueno, tantos problemas. Aquí se trata de una situación coyuntural difícil que tuvo el gobierno de los Estados Unidos, pero en realidad los problemas internos de los estados no constituyen justificación para no dar explicaciones ante instancias internacionales. Y realmente este es un espacio muy importante, esta es una oportunidad que también se le da al Estado de explicar unas políticas, de explicar unas actuaciones, de explicar unas medidas para darle más transparencia a su actuación y también que realmente existen motivos serios para que pues, la sociedad civil, que los peticionarios esperan conocer, pues para permitir un mayor diálogo y un mayor conocimiento. En cuanto a mis inquietudes, realmente van en la línea de las planteadas por Catalina Botero, la relatora para la libertad de expresión, y también las planteadas por por Felipe. Indudablemente es legítimo que los estados intervengan en las comunicaciones de las personas para alcanzar unos fines de seguridad nacional. Ese poder del Estado de vigilar comunicaciones, su legitimidad no está en entredicho. Lo que estaría en entredicho es que no puede ser un poder absoluto. Tiene que estar sometido a unos límites, a unas reglas, a unos procedimientos. Acá hemos recibido información de los peticionarios de que tanto los ciudadanos de los Estados Unidos como en general los extranjeros están siendo objeto de vigilancia. Se dio un estimativo de aproximadamente 1,000 millones de personas, que no solamente se vigila a jefes de Estado y de gobierno, sino que se vigila a periodistas, se vigila a defensores de derechos humanos, e incluso se nos ha dicho que se vigila hasta a la Organización de las Naciones Unidas. Si eso es así, pues también nos preocupa, porque también posiblemente la Comisión Interamericana eventualmente también podría estar sometida a ese poder. Entonces, en ese orden de ideas, yo preguntaría por los límites. Bueno, lo primero que preguntaría es si realmente ese amplio espectro que aquí se ha denunciado de personas vigiladas es cierto o se trata de un ámbito más limitado. Segundo, ¿cuáles son los límites de ese poder? Si existen protocolos, estándares, procedimientos, o qué reglas existen para limitar esa labor de vigilancia de la Agencia de Seguridad de las Naciones Unidas, Agencia de Seguridad de los Estados Unidos, para preservar la intimidad, la privacidad y para preservar la libertad de expresión. Me preocupa mucho el respeto a la intimidad, a la privacidad, a la libertad de expresión. Todos los poderes y los derechos en los estados democráticos tienen que armonizarse. Entonces, en ese orden de ideas, quisiera conocer cuáles son esos límites, protocolos, procedimientos y además qué medidas está adoptando el Estado para prevenir los posibles abusos que pueden haberse presentado en el ejercicio de estos poderes de vigilancia por parte de la NSA. Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Escobar Gil. Can I ask the petitioners if you have some further comments or observations?
We have a number of questions that we would like to put to the United States today, but we would also like to further additional written questions for the United States to answer to the Commission within the next 7 to 10 days. So first of all, Mr. LaRue.
Thank you. Tres preguntas muy concretas y quisiera hacer la primera en español. Estados Unidos siempre fue un modelo en cuanto a la libertad de expresión y al First Amendment, digamos, a la primera enmienda constitucional y a la jurisprudencia que le ha seguido. Y también ha sido un modelo de leyes de acceso a la información, de información pública. Yo entiendo el concepto que hay en Estados Unidos sobre el Bill of Rights y cómo se aplica constitucionalmente de cara a los ciudadanos norteamericanos, pero se me hace complejo y mi pregunta sería si ha habido alguna reflexión a nivel de política exterior y en materia de derechos humanos con organismos internacionales, es cómo plantearse la universalidad de los derechos. Es decir, cómo garantizar de que los derechos humanos son garantías mínimas para toda persona en cualquier parte del mundo, sin importar su raza, color, idioma, cultura o nacionalidad. Y esto siempre ha sido una preocupación sistemática. The second question is more a preoccupation. If the system, if Commissioner Felipe González read what the court itself had said, the special court, and if the system is so massive and moves so fast and has reached out so far, isn't there a breakdown in the judiciary controls? Isn't there a reduction of the role of the judiciary? Isn't there a risk of altering the checks and balances that have traditionally existed in the United States to defend democracy? And finally, the third question, which falls from the first one, is if this is a breakdown of judiciary control and control of the public by access to information, as we have said, isn't there a risk that a system goes out of control and turns against people in the U.S., monitoring political communications or campaigns or elections or breaching privacy? This was exactly the principle of what happened in the Watergate scandal. It was one president and one party monitoring the other. I think we must not think of those issues as issues of the past. We must think of them as issues that we must prevent in the future from happening again, creating precisely the judiciary oversight and the parliamentary oversight that works, then that generates a certain degree of control over these mechanisms.
If I could just offer three brief questions. First is that in the government's public defense of these programs, they've overwhelmingly pointed to domestic law and have argued that domestic law does not provide protections for foreigners when it comes to surveillance by the National Security Agency. But the government has never articulated its view of what constraints international law imposes upon the NSA. And surely it's not enough to say that foreigners are subject to surveillance when it comes to international human rights law. The second question goes to what I view as one of the fundamental problems of the government's surveillance in the last 10 years, which is that the scope is not limited to concerns like terrorism or other concerns that you would think would legitimately override expectations of privacy. It is much broader, and so I would urge the Commission to inquire as to the breadth of the NSA's understanding of its surveillance authority outside of the areas in which we might legitimately expect government surveillance. And finally, there's been a fundamental shift in the way surveillance has been collected in the United States. We've gone from a model of targeted surveillance to one of collecting everything at the beginning and running searches later on. And that shift will have dramatic consequences for privacy going forward, particularly if other countries embrace this model. And so I would urge the Commission to ask the state whether that model of surveillance is necessary to accomplish the goals, the often very targeted goals of the intelligence agencies in accomplishing their mission. Thank you.
I will be very brief. To follow up on Mr. LaRue's point about the surveillance court, I would just identify also the lack of transparency of judicial decisions as another sign of the breakdown of checks and balances and something that should be rectified. And in some ways, we see the court even acknowledging that the lack of transparency in legal decisions is a significant problem and prevents public oversight. I would also be very interested in a response from the state about the Schwane principles review of U.S. law, relevant U.S. law, in light of the Schwane principles. The U.S. In response to concerns that have been repeatedly voiced about the aggressive prosecution and indictments of national security whistleblowers has most recently relied on the October 2012 presidential directive on national security secrecy. But as I've stated in my introductory statement, there are significant limitations of that. And I would be interested in a response from the state about how there is sufficient protection for national security whistleblowers when the presidential directive does not provide for a legal remedy, allows any remedy that is decided by the administrative review mechanism to be only discretionarily applied by the intelligence agency.
and it doesn't apply to contractors. So specifically, how would that apply to some of the specific national security whistleblower cases that have been identified in the United States for whom there would not be sufficient protection?
Thank you very much, petitioners. I'll offer the last word to the state. We would welcome the written elaboration on the questions, which we'll forward to the state along with some of those raised by the special rapporteur, and a particular interest in the extent to which the United States is having regard to the international human rights principles, which are emerging and evolving, including some of the very specific ones which the petitioner has raised. But I offer you the last word.
Just to reiterate our thanks to the Commission, the Commissioners, the Special Rapporteur, and the petitioners for the information and the questions, and to repeat our intention to respond as promptly as possible to all the concerns raised.
Thank you, petitioners, for the information which you've provided us. We look forward to hearing more from you, and we will be following closely up with the United States for the written response to all the questions we've asked. Thanks, everyone.